conditionally invited us PhD for the faculty meeting, and all they did was fight about vacation.
Sarah, did everybody have a copy of the take-home? I mean, it's pretty straightforward, but there's a lot of ways you can go with this. You know, Conference of Cancer Center was kind of started as a result of all of these acts. Yes, ma'am.
Did you want one page or two page?
You can give me two if you want. I'm a big one, so you can do that. But I just don't want you to go to Wikipedia. I also can go to Wikipedia. So I have to do something a little bit more unique. And if you want to cite some references, that would be great as well. And there may be a follow-up question on a subsequent take-home exam. Any questions on the take-home I gave you guys way back when? Has everyone looked at their translocation? Okay. You can always email me. I will not be at class tomorrow because I have a visitor in the laboratory at the same time. So if anybody has any subsequent questions, just make sure to email me. I'm available all weekend, August 7th. The material from today's lecture will be on the exam, as will the rest of the chemotherapy that you hear tomorrow. How was chemo? A lot of material. But I think you can start thinking about mechanisms, cell cycle, all of this is starting to work together. So our speaker today is Dr. Matt Pogorza. He's going to be talking about radiation therapy in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. So I've got about, is it 1 hour that I have?
It is 1 hour.
This year? Okay, very good. Well, thank you, Anne-Marie. As the introduction stated, what I'll be discussing today is how radiation therapy works. And not necessarily as much from the clinical perspective, but maybe more so from the radiobiological and physical perspective. I'm a medical physicist. I've been here for about 25 years now. And during that time, we've seen an incredible evolution in the technology that is available for delivering radiation therapy. I'll show some pictures of the way it was done maybe 20 years ago. And then I'll show some additional pictures in a video that demonstrates how we do radiation therapy today and how our ability to deliver radiation dose has really gotten to the point where we can very accurately spare normal tissue that might be adjacent to malignant tissue. And that's really the name of the game, as we'll see, in radiation therapy, is putting the dose where it needs to go and making sure that any tissue that we don't necessarily want to irradiate is spared to a level such that the patient will not have any significant side effects from the treatment that we give them. If you have any questions during the presentation, please stop me. Oftentimes it's easier to have a discussion about the issue when the slide is still up on the screen. So let's try and keep this as informal as possible. So what we'll do is we'll start by discussing the physical basis of radiation therapy. How do we deliver the radiation dose? What are the physical principles and what types of radiation do we actually use in order to effect that clinical change that we're looking to effect in the patient's tissue? Then we'll talk about a little bit of history of radiation therapy. As I mentioned, there's been a tremendous evolution in our ability to deliver radiation dose very accurately. Then we'll talk about treatment planning. How do we come up with the treatment plans that we need in order to deliver this radiation dose safely and effectively? And then I'll end with a discussion of some of the technology that we use. And as I mentioned, I've got a video that shows one application of radiation to a patient, just to give you a little bit of an idea of how we actually do it using modern technology. So, radiation as a category can be split into two subcategories. We have the so-called non-ionizing radiation, which is comprised of visible light, infrared, ultraviolet light. It's basically the kind of light that we get exposed to. Here, for example, the light that's coming from these ceiling lights, from the sun, potentially. It's light or radiation that does not produce any biological effect other than maybe a suntan or something like that. You're not creating any ionization within the patient's tissues, so that's why it's considered to be non-ionizing. Not very interesting from a radiation therapy perspective because, as I mentioned, you're not creating any real biological effect that could produce the kinds of outcomes that we're looking for. When we go in the category of ionizing radiation, that becomes a little more interesting for us, because that comprises the kinds of radiation that we use in delivering radiation therapy to patients. So ionizing radiation, as the name suggests, causes ionization in materials, right? If you irradiate a block of wood with an ionizing radiation, you're going to cause ionization in the molecules and the components that comprise that block of wood. Same goes if you irradiate a patient, or cells, or an animal, or really anything where you have the ability to cause ionization, it's going to happen. Now, ionization can either be considered directly ionizing, that category of radiation, and that subcategory is comprised of the charged particles that we can use in delivering radiation therapy. So things like electrons, things like protons, things like some of the more esoteric particles, pi mesons, carbon ions. Those have all been applied for radiation therapy, and those comprise the category known as directly ionizing radiation. The largest part of radiation that we use in the vast majority of radiation therapy, not delivered just here, but delivered everywhere, is comprised of indirectly ionizing radiation. And that includes X-rays, gamma rays, and neutrons. Those are the indirectly ionizing radiations. And what that means is that these radiations, in interacting with tissue, they have to first create one of the charged particles that are then considered to be directly ionizing. Okay, so when you have a patient and you are using X-rays, for example, to create radiation therapy for that patient, those X-rays have to first produce a charged particle as they interact with tissue. And then that charged particle will go on and ultimately deliver dose and create that biological effect that we're looking for. Now, what is that charged particle? Some of you, I know, have taken some physics in your background, and you probably remember a little bit of how X-rays interact with tissue, or with any material, for that matter. Who knows what the charged particle would be? Well, it's got to be one of the three that I mentioned, right? Electrons, protons, or neutrons. Which do you think it's going to be?
Electron.
Electron, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what X-rays do in interacting with tissue is they first produce an electron. And then that electron goes on and creates ionization, which ultimately leads to the biological effect that you're looking for. Okay, so keep that in mind. Let me ask you this. What's the difference between an X-ray and a gamma ray? And by source, you probably mean where they originate,
yeah.
Right? So an X-ray originates where?
From the atom.
Mm-hmm.
And the gamma rays from the nucleus.
Exactly. So gamma rays originate within the nucleus of an atom, whereas X-rays, on the other hand, originate outside of the nucleus. Now, if I give you an X-ray of a certain energy and a gamma ray of exactly that energy, will you be able to tell the difference between the two? 50-50 chance if you don't think. What do you think? Yes or no? Say that again? Well, an X-ray and a gamma ray are both members of the electromagnetic spectrum, right? I give you an X-ray and a gamma ray. Exactly the same energy. You don't know where they came from. You're right. You can see that I'm fishing for no, right? If it were yes, I would have been happy. Yeah. It's actually no. You can't tell the difference because they are simply the same entity. They carry no charge, right? They're basically photons. There's no charge associated with them. And once they're produced, you don't know where or how they were produced. They interact with tissue in such a way that's based upon their energy and the structure of the tissue, the composition of the tissue. The two of them will interact exactly the same within the same tissue. Okay? So keep that in mind. Now let me show you another. Actually, we'll get to that in a minute. So as we said then, X-rays are produced in extranuclear processes. And there's two categories of X-rays as well that we can talk about. There's characteristic radiation, characteristic X-rays, and then there's Bremsstrahlung X-rays. Anyone know the difference between those two? And this kind of goes back to chemistry as well, if any of you were chemistry majors in your undergrad.
The Bremsstrahlung, where it like is, or the characteristic is one where one hits it and then another one comes off, drops down.
Yeah, you're right.
The other one is, I don't remember.
Say that again.
Yeah.
That's Bremsstrahlung. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, very good.
I see this picture. Yeah, I don't
know. Yeah. So you guys kind of have the idea. You didn't use exactly the right terminology to describe the idea, but you're on the right path. So characteristic radiation results when you have a transition of an orbital electron, right, from one shell to the next. So when an electron drops from a higher orbital to a lower orbital, a more bound orbital, there's a difference in binding energy of the two orbitals. And that difference then is released potentially as a characteristic X-ray. Now the alternative for that, if one of you gets this right, I'll be really impressed. What's the alternative to characteristic X-ray emission when you have an electron that drops from one shell to the other?
Photon.
Say that again?
Photon.
No, well, that's characteristic X-ray, right? What is the alternative that can happen? Anyone heard of Auger electrons? No? Okay. All right. So that's fine. But that is the alternative. And you can write it down if you want, and you can look it up afterwards. Auger, A-U-G-E-R. Is a name. It's a French scientist that is given the privilege of having this named after him. So that's characteristic radiation. Bremsstrahlung radiation, on the other hand, happens when you have a charged particle that passes very closely to the nucleus of an atom. And that charged particle, usually an electron, it's going to feel attraction to the nucleus, right? Electrostatic attraction. So its direction is going to be bent, as this gentleman here coined the term. Any time that a charged particle's path is changed or deflected, it's going to radiate radiation. And that radiation is known as Bremsstrahlung radiation. The only two categories of X-rays that are out there, characteristic radiation, Bremsstrahlung radiation. In radiation therapy, we make use of both to treat patients. And we'll talk about how we do so in a few minutes. Gamma rays, as we saw, on the other hand, result from intranuclear processes. Okay, the nucleus, the neutrons and protons that comprise the nucleus, they are arranged in such a way that they have nuclear energy levels themselves. When the nucleus is in an excited state, generally means that it is going to try and rearrange itself, its nucleons, right, the protons and neutrons, such that they get closer to the ground state. In doing so, there's going to be a release of energy. And that release of energy is known as a gamma ray. Now, of course, there's an alternative to that, too. Anyone know that? If you didn't know Auger electron, you probably won't know this one. It's called internal conversion, where instead of the gamma ray being emitted, the energy that would be given to the gamma ray is instead given to the innermost electron within the orbitals. And then that electron is ejected. It's called internal conversion. Okay. So, we talked about how we have an unstable nucleus, right? Unstable is another way of saying radioactive. And it tries to get down to its ground state. And one way that it can do that, as we said, was by the emission of a gamma ray. Now, we have some parameters to characterize decay that you've probably heard of, right? This nuclear decay. There's a concept of half-life, right? Half-life represents the amount of time that it takes a nucleus, a radioactive substance, to decay to half of its amount. Okay, that's half-life. And then we have the concept of decay constant and specific activity that become very important when we're considering using a radioisotope for radiation therapy delivery. Any questions so far? Okay. Here's some common isotopes that have been used clinically that we've used across the street in the clinic as well. Cobalt-60 is very important history in radiation therapy. It was really the first isotope that showed some significant clinical efficacy simply because it had a relatively high energy gamma ray. And what that means is that if you were going to treat a patient that has a deep-seated tumor, something very far inside, prostate, for example, a lung, just something that isn't on the surface necessarily, you need a radiation that has a high-energy component to it so that you can reach your target without overdosing the patient's skin, right? So that's where cobalt-60 became very important because of its energy of emission. And don't worry too much about what this unit means, but just look at the relative magnitude of the radiation. So you can see the cobalt has a radiation energy which is about 2 to 3 times higher than what was prevalent before cobalt-60 was introduced, and that's cesium-137. Iodine-125, palladium-103, these have really low energies. What do you think would be an appropriate use for a very low energy radiation? How would you use that clinically in a safe and appropriate way?
Skin cancer?
Sure. Say that again? And how would you apply the isotope in this case? Because remember, it's got very low energy. Look at this. This is two to three orders of magnitude lower than cobalt-60. Exactly. That's what you do. In this case, with these low energy radiations, what you do is you implant the radiation right into the patient's tumor, right into what you're trying to treat. And the benefit of the fact that this is low energy is that it is going to deposit its dose in very close proximity to where you've actually put the seed. So if you're implanting, let's say, a prostate, right, or even a thyroid for that matter, you can do it there too, although we have other ways of treating thyroid that use other isotopes. But what we've done across the street quite often is taken either iodine-125 or palladium-103 in the form of a seed, as you said, and it's usually the size of a grain of rice. And then we would put 50 to 100 of these into a patient's prostate, for example. And then as the seeds decay, they give off radiation, characteristic radiation, some gamma rays as well. And that radiation, because it is low in energy, it doesn't go very far from where the seed is. So the biological effect is limited to the vicinity of where you put the seeds, in this case the patient's prostate. So you can get very conformal deposition of dose that way. And we'll see some pictures of how that works as well. Photons, which comprise X-rays and gamma rays, are part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which you see here. And what we show is wavelength, which is basically frequency, or in another way of saying it, energy of radiation, defines the different category of components that comprise the spectrum. So here, for example, on the very long wavelength range or very low energy range, right, wavelength and energy are inversely related, we have radio waves and microwaves, which are not really ionizing. You can't cause any biological effect with radio waves. In fact, we're bombarded by radio waves all the time, right? Then we go, if we increase the energy, decrease the wavelength here, we go to visible light, which itself is non-ionizing as well. That's what's hitting us right now. But then as we get to the very high energy stuff, X-rays and gamma rays, that's where you get into the ability to create biological effect. Now, every electromagnetic spectrum that I've seen published anywhere, categorized anywhere, always has X-rays as a separate category from gamma rays. We know better, right? Because X-rays and gamma rays are exactly the same. The only difference is that, at least according to the way these spectra are put together, there's a thinking that gamma rays are always higher in energy, lower in wavelength than X-rays, but that's just not the case. So keep that in mind. Whenever you look at a spectrum, more than likely you're going to see gamma rays at the upper end of the spectrum, but that is just a common misconception. That isn't based on any kind of reality. So, we have the components that cause biological effect. And we're going to use those components as part of our radiation therapy process. So we're going to take X-rays or gamma rays, let's say, and we're going to expose a patient's tissue to them. Now, when we do that, the X-rays and gamma rays are going to interact with the patient in one of these three interaction mechanisms. Now, photoelectric interaction was what you had described earlier, where you take a radiation, it interacts in a photoelectric process where it knocks out an orbital electron, right? That electron is then ejected, and then you end up with characteristic radiation. The Compton interaction is a little different, slightly different process, but the same ultimate result, where you get an electron that's produced. And the same is pair production, same process in terms of what is produced. You end up getting an electron as well. So you see now how all three processes here, if you think back to when we talked about non-ionizing or directly and indirectly ionizing radiations, we said that X-rays and gamma rays were indirectly ionizing. They're indirectly ionizing because they produce a charged particle, which itself then creates the ionization, which ultimately leads to the biological effect. Okay, so that electron is the particle that ultimately results in dose being deposited. As I mentioned earlier, we can also use charged particles as direct radiations to deliver radiation therapy. And those I won't talk too much about, but they do interact a little bit differently. They interact by colliding directly with the materials that comprise the patient's tissue. So it's a slightly different paradigm, and they have predictable finite ranges. So don't worry, that's all you need to know about charged particles. Okay, now this is important. And let me spend a little bit of time describing what we see here. This is called a percentage depth dose curve for two different X-ray beams, different in their energy. And what I'm plotting here is dose as a function of depth within the patient, okay, or water as it's depicted here, but it could be the patient as well. And what we see is that in the first few centimeters of the patient's tissue, the dose actually increases, reaching a maximum, and then as we penetrate deeper into the patient's tissue, the dose actually decreases. The depth of maximum dose here is at a deeper point for the higher energy radiation. At any given depth, the higher radiation, energy radiation, also penetrates at a higher level. And this is important. And it kind of relates back to what I was saying, why cobalt 60 was so exciting at the time. Because prior to that, all we had was very low energy radiation, much lower than what you see here. And with very low energy radiation, where do you think the maximum dose is going to be? Exactly. Right on the surface, let's say. Right? That's where you're going to get the maximum dose for very low energy radiation. If you want to treat something that's, let's say, 10 centimeters deep within the patient, what does that mean in terms of the difference between the dose at that point in the patient versus the skin? Skin's going to get much more dose, right? Because you have to deliver a lot of dose to the skin knowing that it's going to fall off very rapidly as the radiation penetrates into the patient. So what's going to be the dose-limiting structure in how radiation therapy was practiced before megavoltage radiation, high-energy radiation, was available? The skin, right? So in the old days, and I've got a picture of this a little bit later, in the old days, the practice of radiation therapy was limited to looking at the patient's skin in the region that was being irradiated and basically delivering dose until the patient could tolerate no more skin dose. Skin erythema, right, is the reaction that you look at. So that was a problem because what that meant was that you couldn't really deliver an effective dose to deep-seated tumors within the patient's body because the skin was always a limiting factor. Now, let's look at what happens here. When you have this high energy radiation, much higher than even cobalt, although cobalt was pretty good too, What is the skin dose here? Very low, right? If you look at this graph here, for the 15 MV beam, you've got about 20% skin dose. So what that means is that if you want to treat something at 10 centimeter depth, where you've got about 70% dose, the skin is only going to get whatever the ratio is between 70% and 20% of the dose. So the skin is now no longer the dose-limiting structure. You don't have to worry about skin dose as much. So you can now really start thinking about delivering effective doses to tumors that are inside the patient's body. And that wasn't possible before the development of cobalt-60 and certainly the development of the kinds of tools and equipment that we have that deliver these kinds of beams. Does that make sense to everyone? You'll have to think about it a little bit later as well, but if you simply look at the shape of this depth dose curve and realize that as the beam energy is increased, the penetrating ability of the radiation is also increased, you start to get a feeling for why megavoltage radiation is so useful. And then we have all kinds of tricks, too, with treatment planning that allow us to optimize the delivery of dose within the patient even more. And let's just briefly talk now about electron beams, charged particles. And what's the first thing, the first difference that you notice between the percent depth dose curve for an electron beam versus an X-ray beam? Say that again.
The rapid fall off.
Right. Rapid fall off. Okay. It falls off very rapidly as a function of depth. Plus, there's a point beyond which you can say that the dose is essentially zero. Not exactly zero, right? But in this tail region here, you can see that the dose is very low. So where would this be a useful radiation? Yeah, I mean, skin stuff as well. Sure. But anything where you've got your target, and then downstream from the target, you have a sensitive structure that you don't want to deliver dose to, right? So if you have something that is, let's say, upstream from the spinal cord, right, some sort of nodal disease or something that is lying right on the spinal cord, what you could do is you could pick an electron energy such that you would know that the range of the electron is not going to allow the dose to go into the patient's spinal cord. So that's where charged particles become a little more exciting, simply because they have this definite range that is predictable. Whereas with X-rays, you don't have that, right? X-rays have the ability to penetrate pretty far into a patient with relatively high dose as well. We don't use electrons very much in radiation therapy, simply because we have other ways of applying photons such that we can mimic some of the benefits of electrons. And I'll show you some pictures of that as well. Real quick, from the perspective of radiobiology, what we need to do is we need to deposit some energy into a target, right? Wherever that target happens to be. The first step is depositing that energy by transferring the energy from the X-rays or gamma rays to an electron, and then the electron itself will interact with components within the patient's cells to create that biological effect. And we saw how the final energy transfer results in the production of that electron. And that electron then creates the biological effect through depositing energy within the target. It's a multi-step process to kill a cell. First thing is we have to identify what the critical volume is within the cell, and what would that be? What would be the critical region within the cell where you want to deposit the energy, or at least where you want to create the change?
Nucleus,
and more specifically?
The
DNA. Yeah, exactly. So damage prevents normal DNA replication and cell division, right? So that's one potential way. And if we look at the two mechanisms here, this is a strand of DNA, of course, and we have what's known as indirect action and direct action. So an indirect action, what we have is the interaction between the photon, right, X-ray, gamma ray, you guys know the drill, and not the DNA strand directly, but the water. It surrounds the DNA, right, within the nucleus. that interaction creates this hydroxyl and hydrogen free radical, and then that free radical can create the damage. Okay, that's called indirect action, because the first thing you have to do is you have to create these free radicals. Direct action, on the other hand, is when the X-ray interacts directly with the strand and then produces the damage that way. Which one do you think happens more frequently? The indirect, right? Simply because the DNA is such a small target, right, relative to what it is swimming in. So indirect action is much, much more prevalent. Sure. So what is a cellular response then, once we've created damage? Well, you can see that. And ultimately what we do is try and create this situation where the cell will not reproduce, right? Or where we can stop the growth. The end point for us sometimes is we get complete resolution of the patient's tumor, right? You can image the patient afterwards and you don't see anything anymore from the perspective of malignancy. That's a terrific end point, but we don't always reach it. Sometimes what you do is you prevent the patient's malignancy tumor from growing, right? You basically stop it in its tracks. Whatever problems the patient has at that point will probably continue, but at least they won't get worse because the tumor will not grow any further. So those are two possible end goals that we look for, and we do achieve them in varying ways with different types of malignancies. What is the response then of the tumor going to be? Well, there's a whole concept of the four R's of radiobiology: repair, repopulation, reoxygenation, and reassortment. I think repair is very straightforward, right? Cells have the ability to repair some of the damage that can be created through radiation exposure, right? There is the ability for cells to do that. And in fact, we'll see later that that's really one of the reasons why radiation therapy works. If that ability wasn't there, then radiation therapy would be very difficult to apply in most clinical cases. What's the concept of repopulation from the perspective of cells? Yeah, they repopulate, right? They just grow. They grow again. Reoxygenation? Why is that one so important? Anyone know? To a certain degree, yeah. But why is oxygen such an important part of delivering radiation therapy?
For
what? Yeah. Because you have to create that free radical, right? So you need oxygen to be there. Now, are all tumors very well oxygenated? No. Some are hypoxic, some are anoxic, right? So the tumors that are anoxic, they still live, right? They still create problems. But when you irradiate an anoxic tumor, or even a hypoxic tumor for that matter, you don't have a lot of oxygen there. So the damage that you're producing is not as large as in the tumor where it is well oxygenated, because you have a lot of oxygen there that can kind of make more permanent the damage that radiation is producing. So if you believe that tumors have hypoxic fractions and anoxic fractions, oxygenation is very important. So if you allow a tumor to reoxygenate, then you're going to get a better outcome for the patient, simply because you're going to get more damage in the well-oxygenated tumor than the one that is not. And then reassortment. Why is that one important? Are all phases of the cell cycle equally responsive to radiation?
No.
What would be the most sensitive phase?
Replication.
When the DNA is out on display, right? And then there are other parts of the cell cycle which are less sensitive. So reassortment, what that does is it allows the cells to reassort into potentially more sensitive parts of their cell cycle, so they respond more to radiation therapy. Yes? It can. Yeah, it can. So in order to make use of these radiobiological concepts, what do we have to do with the radiation? Exactly. with some exceptions, and we can talk about those, but generally speaking, radiation therapy is not delivered in one shot. There's some cases where we do that. But for the vast majority of patients, radiation therapy is delivered in a fractionated regime, which means that you give small amounts of radiation separated by periods of time over many, many days. So the longest fractionation schedule that we currently have is for early stage prostate cancer, where the patient gets a daily treatment every day for 9 weeks. 45 times the patient has to come for treatment. Now, what happens in between applications of radiation? Yeah, you get some repair, right? Because there's time between. There's a day, nominally 24 hours. If it's over a weekend, it's even longer. You get repopulation. You get reoxygenation that can happen. We'll talk about why in a minute. And you get reassortment. Now, it's not all good, right? Repair is good if it's normal tissue. But what else is going to repair? Some of the malignant tissue too, right? But normal tissue generally has a better ability to repair than malignant tissue. Okay, so we have a net benefit there. What about repopulation? Can repopulate as well, the tumors can, right? So this is potentially a problem with fractionation. What about reoxygenation? It's actually a good thing. Because what happens, you want the tumor cells to reoxygenate because you want them to become more sensitive to radiation, right? So if you have a large tumor and the outside part is well vascularized, right? It's close to vessels. Gets a lot of oxygen. As you get away from there, the oxygen tension, if you go towards the center, the oxygen tension falls. So you have hypoxic and anoxic regions. So when you irradiate this thing, what is the part that is going to suffer the most damage? The well-oxygenated part, right? So if you then wait, that part is going to become inactive or whatever the case may be, and you'll get reoxygenation that happens of the parts that were originally hypoxic or anoxic. So when you come back in the next fraction, now the parts that were previously in low oxygenation concentration regions, now they're better oxygenated. So if you apply radiation again, you get a net benefit to that. So reoxygenation is very, very important from that perspective. And then reassortment, the same thing. You want the tumor cells to reassort into more sensitive parts of the cell cycle so that they're more radiosensitive. And if we put that into words, then we mentioned dose fractionation is the paradigm that we use. And we can say that dividing a dose into a number of fractions, right, in the case of the prostate cancer case I mentioned, that's 45 fractions, spares normal tissue by repairing sublethal damage and repopulating normal cells. And it increases damage to tumor cells because, as we mentioned, reoxygenation can occur and reassortment into more radiosensitive phases of the cell cycle can also occur. Does that make sense? Very important concept of why radiation therapy actually works. Yes?
Are like the four bars, like, do they happen at different rates per person or per cancer?
It's a good point. I would say that there is variability among people as well, right, based on their overall health and things, but the greater variability would be among the different cell types that you're talking about, right? So I think that's where you see the larger spread in that, because the cells, they divide at different rates, right? There are different sensitivities. We know that when we treat, for example, prostate cancer, we have to go to a higher ultimate dose than we do, for example, if we're treating lung cancer or breast cancer or something like that. And that's simply because they have different responses, the different cell types do. So if we want to really concentrate in any kind of quantifiable way on what kind of damage we're producing, from the perspective of looking at the tumor as a whole, we can introduce the concepts known as TCP, or tumor control probability, and NTCP, normal tissue complication probability, because we really have to balance those two, right? We want to deliver much dose, a lot of dose, to the tumor so that we can inactivate it and control it. But at the same time, we have to be careful because we pay the price then in normal tissue toxicity within the patient. So we have to really keep in mind both consequences. So TCP is the likelihood of controlling the tumor, kind of makes sense. And then NTCP is the likelihood of creating problems for the patient. Let's dive a little deeper into that. This is what a TCP curve looks like. Sigmoidal in shape, and if you plot the probability of controlling the tumor as a function of the amount of dose that's delivered, what you find, as expected, is the higher the dose, right, the greater the probability that you are going to control that tumor. So one would say, well, geez, let's go to a very high dose, right? So you get 100% probability, or at least let's go to the point where we get 90% probability. Problem is normal tissue complications that increase very rapidly as you start getting to very high doses. So let's take a look here at some examples. So let's look at dose A, right here. Dose A is not going to produce any complications at all, because it is basically zero on the NTCP curve. No complications. But what is the likelihood that we're going to control that tumor?
No.
10%, right, based on the graph. Not very good. 10% of the patients, yeah, sure. We don't know which 10% are going to respond in a good way, right? You're going to have 90% of patients that won't. So you can't deliver you can't be this safe and deliver that low a dose. It's not going to be an efficacious treatment. So, and you would say, well, let's get up to a dose here where we have 90% probability of controlling the tumor, right? That would be dose C. But look at the complications now that you're going to create. So now all of a sudden, you've gone from zero complication at this low dose all the way up to somewhere around 70, 75% complication rate. And that's too high in most cases. So generally, we try and sit somewhere around dose B, where we've got about a 70% chance of controlling the tumor, and at the same time having only about a 10% probability of complications within the patient. This varies a little bit. These graphs, the location of the graphs, in terms of how close they are or how far apart they are, is dependent on the kind of cell that you're treating. Now, what if NTCP was on the other side of TCP? Would radiation therapy work? Wouldn't work, right? Because you'd always have more complications than you would probability. And there are some cancers out there where these two are very close. It's very difficult to treat with radiation therapy in that case. So there are other treatments that those patients can receive. Make sense? Is this concept clear?
Very. It's
a combination. Right, because you're right. What this is, it's not really specific necessarily to the fractionation schedule that's being used. Sure, that needs to be looked at as well when deciding how a patient's going to be treated. But as far as concepts go, this is really the best way of demonstrating the difference and the whole issue of really having to be aware of what the probability of complications is going to be for a patient. Because the last thing you want to do is control their disease, right? Well, it's the first thing you want to do, right? But at the same time, create a lot of side effects that impact their quality of life afterwards. Right? So we always have to be very careful with that. There's always going to be some side effect to what we're doing. We just have to make sure that it's in this range where it is reasonable and acceptable. Okay, let's switch into the history of radiation therapy. So it all started in 1895. When Rentgen discovered X-rays, right? And it happened very quickly afterwards that within about 6 years, they already started to know what the potential was in terms of biological effect from this new entity called X-rays was going to be. And Becquerel, Marie Curie, her husband Pierre Curie, they very, very quickly learned what the biological effect of radiation exposure was going to be. And it's only 6 years, right? From the concept of X-ray. You know why they called it X-ray? They didn't know what it was. So they said, well, we don't know what it was, we're going to mark it an X. And that's why they called it X-rays. And it stuck. I'm still calling it X-rays. And early radiation therapy then used this isotope that Marie Curie worked on called radium. And that was really the way that radiation therapy was delivered. This is the historical picture of Rankin's wife's hand. She had a ring on her finger right here. And she happened to walk by his lab when he was doing a totally unrelated experiment. And in the corner of his eye, he saw that he had acquired a picture of his wife's hand. And what I always find remarkable is that if you look at the quality of this, and keep in mind, this was back in 1895, with no real photographic plate or anything similar to the kind of technology we have now. Not a bad image, right? And you can see the bones of the joints over here, and you can see the finger bones. It's quite remarkable, actually, how good that picture was. It's Rankin, Becquerel, Marie, and Pierre Curie. They were honored at various times by various countries through having their pictures placed on stamps. So they're very, very important from the perspective of what we do in medicine. Pierre Curie's arm. This was the first evidence back in 1901 of a biological effect. So what he did was he took some radium that he and his wife were working on and he said, well, I'm going to stick it on my arm and I'm going to see what happens. That's what happened. He got a radiation burn. And that burn would have never healed because the dose that he received was beyond the capability of skin regenerating itself. Now, he never really suffered severe consequences from this, simply because he died before the consequence could become a problem for him. Anyone know how he died? It's actually very humane. He got kicked in the head by a horse. He was changing his horse's shoe, right? The horseshoe. And the horse kicked him, and that was it. And it was humane in the sense that he probably would have died either from this not healing, or what did a lot of the early researchers die from? Leukemia, right? There's some solid tumors as well, but generally the leukemias come first. And a lot of the early people that were working on this, because they had no concept of radiation safety or radiation exposure, they were exposing themselves to really enormous amounts of radiation, simply because they didn't know any better. So it was... Anyway, this was really the first application of radiation. And then if we look to 1922, this is when the real practice of radiation therapy started to evolve. Kind of looks barbaric, right, by today's standards. But at this point, this patient at that time had some sort of oral cancer. And what they decided to do was to take this plaque, right? Some sort of a plaque, I guess we can call it. And then infused into it are these sources of radium-226. And as the radium would decay, it would give off radiation. That radiation would have biological effects on this patient's mouth and presumably his tumor as well. And this would be left on his face until he could tolerate the pain no longer. Because remember, where's the maximum dose going to be? On the skin, right? Not going to be at the tumor, unfortunately, but it's going to be on the skin. So the patient's skin is going to become the dose-limiting structure in this case. It's the best that they could do at the time, other than some sort of surgery, radical surgery. But there was no way of really knowing where the dose was going, nor was there any regard for radiation safety. So that was then. This is what we can do now. Similar case. Okay, what you see here is a CT scan in the sagittal plane. Kind of see where the patient's eyes would be. This is mid-sagittal, so the eyes are on both sides of this slice. Brain up here. And this patient had some sort of intraoral problem as well. And it's not the same patient as before, clearly, but the anatomy is similar. And what this shows here is a dose color wash. So what I'm projecting here is how we can deliver radiation. So red, of course, is going to be higher than blue, right? It's kind of the general color scheme that's used to depict magnitude. And the red region right here, this red contour, represents the target. So that's what we identified in this patient as needing radiation therapy. So what we look for is to have the red overlay what we've identified as a patient's problem, right? It's great. Putting a lot of dose where it needs to go. But the important aspect now is to look at where the blue is, right? Dose, in order to get it inside the patient's body, it's got to come through the patient's skin to the body and whatever other structures are there. What would be the dose, a dose-limiting structure in this part of the patient's body?
The brain.
Brain, yeah, although you'd be surprised. The brain isn't the most limiting structure.
Salivary glands?
Salivary glands, yeah, that's a good point, and we'll address that a little bit later as well. But the spine is an important one, simply because if we overdose the patient's spine, patients can be paralyzed from that level down. And that would be an unacceptable consequence of treatment. So what we see here is that the blue part of the acidose distribution, this color wash, actually overlays where the spine is. So we're able to keep the dose to the spine very, very low. Similarly, if we were to look at the parotid, which would be, you know, kind of a little bit of this side of the slice and inside the screen, and down here there's a salivary gland as well, we want to minimize the dose to those organs too, simply because if you overdose the patient's parotid or the salivary glands, what's going to happen?
Xerostomia,
yeah. Exactly, exactly. That's a very bad side effect. It's not going to kill the patient, but it will impact their quality of life after treatment. So to make a long story short, what we do is we take all of these considerations and we put them together and we come up with treatment plans that allow us to put the dose where it needs to go and, importantly, keep the dose away from structures that we don't want to irradiate or we don't want to irradiate much. So that's really the name of the game in treatment planning. Team includes a radiation oncologist, physicist, dosimetrist, radiation therapist, nurse, social worker, administrator. It's a big group of people. We have about 100 people across the street that participate in the care of anywhere from 140 up to 160 patients per day. So that's the number of patients that we see every single day. And these are the individuals that are involved in delivering that care. We have various responsibilities, but generally we work very collegially as a team in order to treat these patients. So the goal is to concentrate dose to target tissues and minimize dose to healthy tissues. Makes sense, right? Reasonable goal. We have different ways of doing things. I've got about, it looks like, 5 minutes left here, so I won't go into too much detail regarding this, but teletherapy is the concept that is most widely used for radiation therapy. Brachytherapy, on the other hand, is what we addressed earlier when we talked about prostate seeds and putting them directly into the patient's target, right? That's called brachytherapy because you're putting the radiation in close proximity to where the dose needs to be delivered. Teletherapy means the radiation is far away from where the dose needs to be delivered. Here's an example of a prostate patient, and you've got this slide. You can look at it in the handout, so I won't go into too much detail regarding that. That neither. You got the slide there. Different kinds of brachytherapy. Teletherapy. Megavoltage. That represents the radiation that we currently use to deliver most radiation therapy to patients. And it's called megavoltage simply because it is the highest energy radiation that can currently be produced. And that creates the benefit because, as we saw earlier on the percentage depth dose curve, the maximum dose doesn't happen on the patient's skin. It's very important that that be the case. This is a treatment machine. It's called a linear accelerator. Patient lies on the table. In fact, I'll show you the video in a minute regarding how this machine is applied to a patient in order to deliver one fraction of radiation therapy. And it's a real-time video, so you'll get a sense of how long it takes as well. Patient flow, you can review that yourselves. It is in the handout. Some imaging equipment that we use as well in order to get those images that we need in order to find out where the patient's problem area is in relation to the normal tissue that we want to avoid. Here's an example of a patient that's got a brain malignancy where we incorporate MR, magnetic resonance imaging, in addition to CT. You can see on the CT scan, this is a patient's same brain. You kind of have a hint that the patient's got a problem here, but you don't know the full extent, right? That's where the soft tissue visualization that is possible through MR becomes very important, because that gives you a better idea of where the patient's true problem is. Some concepts that you guys can read about. This is the, as identified on an image, the patient's tumor, okay, called the gross tumor volume. And that's not the end of the story, though, because whenever you've got a tumor, you've got extent of tumor cells that go beyond where you can actually visualize a tumor on an image, right, either an MR scan or a CT scan. So that creates the concept known as the clinical target volume, which includes much more tissue than just what you've identified as the patient's tumor. Because you know that in this area here, between the tumor and the extent of the CTV, you've got abnormal cells as well, that if you don't irradiate, they're just going to grow back. Then we have a few other volumes that we talk about, the ITV, the internal target volume, and then ultimately the planning target volume, which defines what becomes the target for us for the delivery of radiation therapy. So you can see how this is where you've identified the patient's tumor. However, this is the volume of tissue that you're actually going to have to irradiate in order that you can adequately control the tumor. So just some concepts for you to understand as well. So this is a prostate cancer patient, and you can see down here, in red would be the region that you're trying to treat. It's kind of a squished down prostate in this patient's case. And then you've got the clinical target volume as well. You can see how much bigger the planning target volume is. And then here would be the patient's bladder, which would be an organ that you don't want to irradiate, so that we would have to take into consideration as well, in order that we wouldn't overdose the patient's bladder. Same goes for the rectum down here posteriorly. And this then represents the kind of dose distribution that we would ultimately deliver, where you can see that we're treating the patient's prostate quite effectively, and we've got the lower part of the radiation dose, which would be over here, the femoral heads, the bladder, and the rectum, not really included within the high dose region. So this patient's treatment would be considered to be quite effective from the perspective of the physical deposition of dose. This is another example showing the dose distribution in the axial plane, the coronal plane, and the sagittal plane. So again, this is a color wash. Red represents high dose. Blue represents low dose. So you want the red, of course, to overlap where the patient's problem area is. And that's, in fact, what we see. And then you want the blue to overlap the normal tissue that you don't want to irradiate. So you can see how we've got the rectum here carved out. We do irradiate a little bit of the bladder. Up here you can see on the sagittal plane. But as long as we take into account the volume of bladder and don't exceed a certain volume receiving a certain dose, the patient won't have too many complications from this treatment. That's just a close-up view. Another anatomy that we would treat. I like to show this because this patient's got some sort of tumor on this vertebrae right here, the vertebral body. But then, of course, inside you've got the spinal cord. So it's quite remarkable how we can carve the dose around the spinal cord, which we don't want to irradiate, yet deliver full dose in very close proximity to where that organ at risk would be. So it's really remarkable. This is something we wouldn't be able to have done even as recently as 10 years ago. The technology has evolved so rapidly. Just a different view, again showing the cord, spinal cord. This is the vertebral column, and this is where the patient's tumor was. And it's quite a remarkable treatment that can be delivered. Okay, so let me get to that video that I promised you, and then we'll call it a day. So rapid arc is kind of the trade name of the technique here. So what you see, patient's lying on the table, and remember this is real time. We're treating something in the patient's head and neck, so it could be similar to the distribution, dose distribution that we looked at. Patient is immobilized. He's got a red mask on his face to keep him still so he doesn't move during treatment. As this machine rotates around the patient, the shape of the beam, which is defined by the opening within the collimator here, called the collimator, changes because the shape of the tumor is different depending on the angle at which you are looking at it, right? So we have to change the shape of the radiation beam as the beam rotates around the patient so that we can maximize just hitting the tumor and staying away from any normal structure. So that's in fact what is happening as the machine rotates around the patient. Dose is being delivered to the patient of varying amounts and varying shapes, with the ultimate goal being that once the machine stops down at the bottom, we have delivered that patient's one fraction of radiation. And hopefully that dose will conform very tightly to where the patient's target volume was and not irradiate the parotid gland or the salivary glands to the level where the patient's going to get xerostomia or have other problems. So that was it. That is the treatment delivery for that patient. Yes?
So when you're doing dose planning for this, you can mess around with how many different beams and at like what angle they get delivered at.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, if we had more time, I would talk about that as well. What we do is something called inverse planning now, where we basically tell the computer we want the parotid, it can't receive more than, let's say, 45 gray to 10% of its volume. We don't want the spinal cord to ever go above 45 gray. We don't want the minor salivary gland to go above whatever, right? And then we tell the computer, this is what we want, go off and calculate for us. And it goes and it calculates. And it looks at all the possibilities of all the degrees of freedom that we have here. And there's an immense number of degrees of freedom, right? As the gantry rotates around the patient. And it then tells us, well, if you apply radiation like this, like this, like this, like this, the solution, the total dose distribution, will then meet the constraints that you told me to meet. Mm-hmm. Can't always do it, yeah. Right? But more often than not, if you set reasonable constraints and you push the system a little bit, you'll get to the level where you come up with a treatment plan that the patient can tolerate and that will be effective from the perspective of how much dose you're actually delivering to the patient. So it's really a fascinating process right now, how treatment planning works. In the old days, it was a very manual process. Mm-hmm. Now it's automated to the degree where you get some really, really complex dose distributions. So, one more slide. So really, this is the end of the story here then. So what we're always looking to do is to improve tumor control, right? We want to control as many patients as possible from the perspective of their tumor growth. We want to increase the tumor control probability. At the same time, however, we want to reduce morbidity. We want to create the scenario where patients have excellent quality of life afterwards, so they're not hampered or handcuffed by dry mouth or other complications. So really, the way that we can accomplish these sort of competing goals that take us in opposite directions, actually, is to come up with more complex treatment techniques or calculational methods, like I just talked about, inverse planning, or develop new technologies. And there's a number of new technologies out there right now that are being studied. There's some early adopters of those new technologies as well that potentially could create even better outcomes than what we currently have from the perspective of controlling disease and minimizing side effects for patients. If we can minimize side effects, what does that mean we can do? Be more aggressive, exactly. Exactly. If you're happy with the side effect level profile that you've got, and you have a technique where, in principle, you could lower the side effects, well, why not be more aggressive, right? Deliver more dose to the tumor and live with that same side effect profile. That's, in fact, what we've done quite often over the past few years, given the new technology. So you have better outcomes then, in principle. Great. Any questions? No? I know some of you have a little more inside knowledge about radiation therapy. I know Sarah spent at least two summers with us, if not three. Yeah, and we actually have a clinical physicist who is sitting in the back over here that has a lot of experience with radiation therapy as well. So I hope I didn't tell anything wrong. All right, great. Thank you, everyone.